This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It is devastating to have someone you care about commit suicide. Public health officials in Vermont are working to lower the number of suicides in the state with a new strategy. Right now, Vermont has a higher rate than the national average. Deaths by suicide account for more deaths than car accidents or homicides in our state, and they say that is not acceptable. There's a framework they've adopted called Zero Suicide. It's a concept created by the National Suicide Prevention Resource Center. And the central focus is the idea that, and I'll quote here, suicide deaths for individuals under care within health and behavioral health systems are preventable. The new platform was just released by the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center, and we're going to learn more about how key players are dealing with suicide as a public health issue and how they hope to reach that zero suicide goal. I'm joined now by Joellen Turalo-Falk, director of the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center. Joellen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Jane.
And also by Jay Batra, medical director of the Vermont Department of Mental Health. Dr. Batra, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much.
So Zero Suicide is the framework for this new platform just released on how Vermont is going to tackle the idea and the question of suicide prevention. That seems like an unattainable goal. Joellen, what's the purpose of using that language, zero suicide?
Well, we weren't responsible for identifying the title of this particular approach. Basically, it's an aspirational goal, and I think what it aims to speak to is that although suicide is complex and there are always multiple causes, including psychiatric illnesses that may have not have been recognized or treated, that the illnesses in general are treatable, and that we want to shore up the early and crisis identification and our ability of the mental health and healthcare systems to respond in a timely and effective way.
And what does that mean in the idea of zero suicide, the platform and the model here, Dr. Batra? It says that there's an understanding that suicide is preventable, as Joellen just said, for people who are under care within health and behavioral healthcare systems. What does that mean exactly?
What does zero suicide
mean? What does it mean that suicide is preventable for those who are in some kind of healthcare setting?
So, Jane, one of the things that, and maybe I'll answer your first question to Joellen first, is the Henry Ford Health System, which laid the foundation for zero suicide program, which got adopted in the national plan, and they sat down with their clinicians, and they had the very first question was, how can we attain this? This is not doable. We're setting ourselves up for failure. And so they sat around in a room and said, tell us how many suicides are acceptable in our healthcare system. And nobody could come up with a number other than zero. So that's where the term got coined, zero suicide. But what that translates to is coordinating our systems to much better screen people who may not know how to ask for help or may think it carries too much stigma or may have understandings that this cannot be fixed. So the first part is talking with people, understanding that they are going through this, removing the taboo of this conversation, because virtually every other health conversation we can have with our providers. So better screening, and when people get screened, doing better assessment of what's going on for them, and then focusing on suicidality as its own problem. And that's where most of the research has been in the last decade, but certainly in the last 5 years or so. That tells us that outcomes are much, much better when you address suicidality as its own problem, as opposed to what standard practice is focusing on contributor problems like depression, like trauma, like anxiety. Not that those aren't important, but in addition to that, focusing on the suicidality itself. So that new framework.
In other words, if somebody is contemplating suicide, that in and of itself is an issue that you'd like to treat separate from saying that's just part of your depression.
Absolutely.
So if that's the case, if the idea here is that we are aiming towards prevention, we're working as a state on mental health care, we're working on destigmatizing the idea that you can get mental health care treatment or that you can reach out for help. Joellen Turalo-Falk, why do you think Vermont's suicide rate is higher than the national average?
Oh, there are a variety of potential reasons for that. One is that Vermont has an older population than most of the nation. suicide is highest among a middle-aged and elder demographic. So that is one possible cause. We have above state average uses of substance abuse, which is often highly related to suicide. As we know, alcohol is a drug that is a depressant, and when people are using substances regularly and or to cope, that depresses their ability to use positive coping strategies and do self-care and do the kind of help-seeking that ultimately gets them into a circuit of care and support.
This suicide platform, suicide prevention platform that you've just come out with, is a little bit changed from 2012. And my understanding of the 2012 system was that one of the main focuses was really targeting young people, because young people are at high risk of suicide. And this is, I believe, still the second leading cause of death among Vermonters aged 10 to 24. Have you made a departure in this new platform from really focusing heavily on young people and perhaps looking more at that older population that is at high risk?
We were fortunate in Vermont for the last 7 years through three-year federal grants from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration to develop strategies specifically around preventing suicide with youth and young adults ages 11 to 24. However, a couple of years ago, the Vermont Suicide Prevention Coalition, which is composed of over 40 agencies, organizations, individuals who are vested in the premise that suicide is preventable and that we can work together to address it, decided to expand the coalition from a focus on youth and young adults to one across the lifespan. So, yes, the current Suicide Prevention Platform 2015 identifies strategies for effective and evidence-based approaches to suicide across the lifespan.
We are talking today about suicide prevention. We're looking at this new platform just launched by a coalition of advocates and health professionals in Vermont to address suicide prevention, to try to get to the goal of zero suicide. We're looking a little bit at how these strategies are different from the previous platform and prevention work that these groups have done. And also, we're going to look at the resources that are devoted to suicide prevention and mental health care in the state of Vermont and see if they're robust enough. I'd like to know what questions you have, listeners. If you want to weigh in on what works in terms of prevention, or if you'd like to tell us your own story, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dr. Batra, I want to just double back to the conversation we were having a moment ago about working with people who are in the healthcare system to try to prevent suicidality and address that issue. How do you get people into the healthcare system to begin with? Because, you know, as we've heard from Joellen, in many cases, people who commit suicide have often untreated mental health care needs. So how do you reach people and treat them and get them into some kind of healthcare system to address all of these issues?
Jane, you have probably put your finger on the biggest challenge we have ahead of us. I will talk about some strategies, but there is a lot more to be done. One of the things we're doing is partnering with the Blueprint for Health team, Craig Jones, Beth Tansman, and they are having screenings happening at the medical homes about depression. If you screen positive for depression, or there is suspicion, then there is another questionnaire that asks about suicidality. At the same time, we're building an infrastructure that supports what happens after you screen, which would mean that there are clinicians who in the community health teams who would get trained in doing a more thorough assessment of suicidality, and then for us to create a referral network of who folks can get treatment from who are specialized in suicide care. We're also partnering with SASH, which is an organization that supports older folks in their homes. And that's somebody who's reaching out to – that organization reaches 5,000 people. We're also working with state employee human resources, so that's another 5,000, 6,000 people. Again, a lot remains to be done, but that's our approach. And children, of course, we reach through schools and families and well-child visits from pediatricians' offices. And so there's it's a multi-pronged strategy.
So, Joellen, how do you talk to people who are in positions to be helpful, you know, beyond mental health care providers and health care providers? I imagine school counselors are some of the people that you talk with and that you work with in this coalition. But what about people like, I don't know, HR directors at businesses, clergy members? Do you talk to all kinds of people about how to identify people who might be at risk or having suicidal thoughts?
You know, we were just discussing from a strategic point of view the importance of including the workplace in outreach to the Department of Labor about this and employee assistance programs and shoring up their skills and identification in workplaces to recognize peers, coworkers, and employees that may be at risk, and then knowing what to say and do, how to get them into a setting where they can be screened and then, you know, assessed when that's necessary. We are taking an expansive community approach that includes all professionals. In Vermont, we have implemented the You Matter for Communities training, and we have developed Vermont specific professional protocols under a contract from the Department of Mental Health for law enforcement, emergency medical providers, schools, colleges, social services, faith leaders. We have a long way to go in terms of disseminating these throughout those networks in order to fine-tune their policies and professional practices within each profession. We're also working, as Dr. Batra said, to integrate suicide prevention into healthcare. And one of the things that we have learned over the past 5 to 10 years of research is that it's really important to prioritize the connectedness of people to their family and friends at all levels, to have a focus on, you know, engaging the person's or individual's natural support network. And so there are a lot of difficulties in minimizing restrictions on the contact or engagement with the family, but that's a direction we need to head. It's understood that collaborating with the patient themselves and with the family and natural support network on identifying a safety plan to ensure that a person who's in crisis gets the support they need and is in a safe setting for as long as needed to get them out of the crisis, and then to begin effective treatment focused on learning skills for coping and self-care and help-seeking.
We're talking about suicide prevention today. Let's go to Xenia, who's calling in from Barrie. Hi, Xenia. Go ahead.
Hi, Joelle, and hi, Jay. One crucial point, and I worked in the mental health system for 10 years, and before that, I was a customer, and I was in the graduate program in community mental health at Trinity, so I've seen a lot of sides of the system in Vermont. One key thing is that people that are feeling suicidal need to feel befriended and treated kindly. Some inpatient settings do this well, others do it very poorly. For example, the law professor that killed herself, she went into that hospital in Burlington that just changed its name again, and she didn't like what she found there or how she was treated, so she got out at the earliest opportunity, bought a gun, and shot herself. Now, when I worked at the Little Crisis Residence in Barrie, everybody that we took in, from the beginning, being kind and trying to be understanding and listening well, and during the intake, you know, when did you last eat? Would you like some juice? Do you need to step outside and smoke? Trying to be user-friendly and ally with the person, whatever it means, that sometimes the system gets so caught up in physical safety that you get some version of what happened to the law professor, that people are so turned off that they say, let me get out of here. This place is treating me like I'm in prison.
Xenia, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Xenia talking about Cheryl Hannah, whose death was reported and well-known to many people about a little over a year ago now. Dr. Batra, you are the medical director of the Department of Mental Health. What about that idea of kindness as part of the treatment model and part of the way that you deal with people generally, even in moments of very acute mental health crisis?
Well, Jane, kindness, empathy, and compassion are the core beliefs or the core infrastructure of the healthcare system. Certainly, psychiatry and mental health is not exceptional to that. So I think that is absolutely the core value we need to hold.
And are we doing it?
What we are doing to foster that, to enhance that, is one of the trainings that we are promoting with our two pilot sites for suicide-specific care. The acronym is CAMS, which stands for Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicide. And that, what Xenia spoke about, is the very foundation of that training. And in fact, what Dr. Jobes told us about that training is the very first conversation starts something like, I can't put enough infrastructure around you to keep you from dying by suicide, but I can work with you so we can find a common solution out. So it is explicitly a partnership that respects the person and their own expertise, but also in collaborating with a clinician who can help them get out of that crisis. So that is something we're promoting, and we have 60 clinicians who are trained, and we're looking to expand that.
Today we're talking about suicide prevention in Vermont. We're looking at how advocates and mental health leaders want to help reach people before they take their own lives. We've been talking a little bit about this new platform and about the idea of zero suicide. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about specific groups that are at risk of suicide. We're going to talk about prevention areas that haven't been discussed. Dr. Batra is working with gun shop owners and with a coalition to talk about how do you talk about this among gun owners and at gun shops. We're talking about suicide prevention and hearing from you as well. Our number, if you would like to weigh in, if you have a question, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Back in a minute here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about the zero suicide model and why a Vermont coalition thinks that's the right approach to suicide prevention. We're talking with Joellen Turalo-Falk, director of the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center, and Dr. Jay Batra, medical director of the Vermont Department of Mental Health. And we're hearing from some of you as well. If you'd like to share your thoughts on what would help prevent suicide in Vermont, where our rate is higher than the national average, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Christy who says, we live in one of the most expensive states in America. Jobs are few and far between. And what is out there does not allow for people to take time off for any kind of illness, let alone a mental illness. What we need to do is look at our state as one collective organism that relies on everyone and everything else in order to be healthy. We need to ensure fair wages, sick pay, medical leave, and teach understanding, tolerance, and peaceful conflict resolution in our schools as well as our workplaces. We need to work on removing the stigma that comes with mental illness and treat people like human beings first and foremost. What we also have to work on is the heroin problem here in the state. Joellen, that idea of thinking of our state as one collective organism that relies on everyone and everything else in order to be healthy, is that something that you think about when it comes to looking specifically at an issue like suicide and suicide prevention?
Absolutely, and that was beautifully stated. What we have done in Vermont is taken what we call an ecological approach to this issue, and in particular, we're working across three sectors. Education, so that's our pre-K, which has a lot of exposure to with families, through school-aged into young adult, which is our community college and state system through a network of institutions of higher ed, across the lifespan, increasingly working to infuse suicide prevention into elder care systems. And The second sector, as we've discussed, is healthcare, which includes mental health and substance abuse services, primary care, medical practices, emergency rooms, et cetera. And the third sector is community providers, which, you know, many of our mental health workers are at the community level. And we also have juvenile justice, foster care, social services, and other person-serving organizations in that third sector. The platform outlines strategies for 11 goals across a spectrum of care for individuals and families. It suggests strategies for organizations, whether they be community-based, faith-based, or business. Then it outlines strategies for each goal, for healthcare, for policies and systems, et cetera. So we have very much taken the ecological approach she was talking about. I'd also just like to mention that the coalition made a very conscious effort to create a public information approach to suicide prevention, which has become known as the You Matter. And You Matter was selected because of the duo nature of its message. You matter because you may need help, and you matter because you may be able to help. And what we're talking about with Zero Suicide is being able to shore up the skills of all our professionals and our family members so that we can do the kind of natural and professional screening and then assessing when someone needs help and getting them into an effective pathway of care and following up to make sure that they are in that pathway of care and surrounded by the network of support they need until they're out of crisis.
And we should mention that You Matter campaign, for people who want to look it up or hashtag it here in our social media world that we're in, is a U as in the letter U, You Matter. It's very, very of the times, I suppose, Joellen.
It is, and we actually were responsible for identifying one of the first You Matters in the nation. We have a couple of websites, the You Matter, youcangethelp.com is an award-winning youth and young adult website. And we also have the vtspc.org website, which provides resources for professionals across the lifespan related to suicide prevention. That's www.vtspc.org.
We got a note from Ben in Cambridge, New York, who says, Vermont has a suicide problem and it is linked to its lack of sensible gun regulations. The Vermont Suicide Prevention Platform mentions gun education but not gun regulation, a policy response that has been proven to reduce firearm deaths. Dr. Batcher, can you talk about that and maybe why that's not an approach that this coalition has taken to talk about gun restrictions?
Thank you, Jane. Means of suicide is a very important conversation. We at the coalition have discussed it several times. What we have not chosen to do is get into an argument for or against guns. What we are doing is partnering with the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs and Chris Bradley and Dwina and our team, including Joellen's team, Alex from her team. We've met a few times now, and we are starting what's called the Gun Shop Project, which is equipping gun shop owners with information on what to look for when somebody is thinking about suicide, and that's what maybe they're buying a gun for, but also providing information that's available to people coming into the shop either to buy guns or ammunition and give them or direct them to the kind of help that may be able to get them from that. Also resources about gun safety when somebody is going through a crisis rather than a much more divisive topic of gun control or not. The Sportsman Club is very eager to work with all its partners, including the coalition, to do this work. We just think that's a much more constructive pathway for gun safety rather than a debate.
And this is something that's been done in New Hampshire and been looked at in other states, right?
That is exactly the model we are using, is New Hampshire's, and we've had great partnership with Elaine Frank and the Gun Safety Coalition there.
What do you advise gun shop owners to look for in identifying somebody who may be coming in to purchase a gun because they are suicidal?
Now, we don't expect gun shop owners to become clinicians, but just like they, just from conversation, can tell that this person may be thinking about using a gun for for dangerous purposes towards others, that would be the same thing. Is what are you looking to buy a gun for? How can I help you? Just start a conversation, and if they get the sense that this person is seeming down, hopeless, then they can direct them towards help rather than and then engage them at a later time if they do want to learn how to use a gun safely.
From other things that I was reading about this project, it's also looking at things like, does this person seem to not care what kind of firearm they're purchasing? Are they only interested in buying a few bullets? You know, some signs that you might see that somebody plans to use this once and doesn't really care what type it is. Those are concerns that a gun owner might be able to, or a gun shop owner might be able to recognize, because people come in and they're often hiding what their feelings are.
Certainly. And that's what the Chris Bradley and Dwayne are telling us, is that that's how they would go about doing it.
We got another note from Gregory who says, I've known a few people touched by this, but it was a sick or a dying elderly family member with no way to relieve suffering. Very sad that people are not, quote, allowed to end their life on their own terms. And Gregory says, it begs the question, do you own yourself and your life? Keeping people alive when they don't want to live is just ridiculous. Joelle and Terwilliger, I'd love for you to address Gregory's note, because, you know, I think beyond the question of somebody who's sick or dying is this question of owning your own life and owning what you can and should be able to do with your body.
Yeah, we are having substantive discussions about that a couple of coalition meetings ago. Now, keep in mind, we meet quarterly, and we try to identify those issues that need to be discussed. We invited a representative of the Division of Aging and Independent Living, otherwise known as DALE, of the Agency of Human Services, and we had a discussion about this. This is not an either-or situation. This is recognizing people who are despondent and need support to live in a way that has integrity for their lives. We don't want people to die by suicide when they are feeling neglected, isolated, and depressed for those kinds of reasons.
Let's go to Judy calling in from Randolph. Hi, Judy. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have I had a sister who was despondent and had depression pretty much all of her life. She was always suicidal when she was depressed. She did not die. She died at 83, not of a suicide. But several years before that, she wrote a poem called Suicide Seduction. It's a short poem, only 12 lines. I've shared my life with her all those years, and I never understood what it felt like until she wrote this poem, and she had my permission to use it, and I gave it to Dr. Lou DiNicola in Randolph because I taught in high school, and there's suicidal things going on there. And anyway, I wanted to share this poem because it put a different light on it that I've ever had, and it's suicide talking. Come. Come with me, and I will take away your pain, your anger, too, and all that makes you cry. The world will think you've gone insane, and all who know you will always wonder why. Don't they know that every hour is hard, and every breath and every step is, too? And your bridges are not burned, but charred. There are no other moods but blue. The end will be sweet. It's the time before to dread. It's like dying twice, to wake again and wage another daily war. Come, come with me. The end is nice.
Judy, thank you for reading that poem, and thank you for sharing your sister's story. That helped you understand maybe a little bit more what she had been feeling and going through?
Oh, completely. I mean, just my and also with some some students that I had. Hmm. Who in some cases they did, and in a lot of cases they did not kill themselves. But I didn't understand. I mean, depression, yes, I understood that. But I didn't understand that it really seemed like a release to those people from all the pain that they'd been going with, and in her case, almost all of her life.
Judy, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Joelle and Terwilliger, I want to make sure that in the couple minutes that we have left, we talk a little bit about perhaps specific ways to target people who are at higher risk of suicidal thought than other people, because you mentioned that one of the things that you're doing is taking this whole lifespan approach and looking at, you know, everybody throughout their lifetimes. But we also know that there are people who are at greater risk. For example, young people who are lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, or questioning are at a higher risk. What's your approach to helping these young people to try to make sure that we're lowering that risk factor?
So we have partnerships with various agencies and organizations around segmented populations. I mentioned working with the DALE, trying to expand the strategies for the elder population. We do have a partnership with Outright Vermont, which provides services statewide for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered youth. And so we do awareness there. I think that that poem spoke about the persistent feelings of low hopelessness, pessimism, and purpose in life. And that's directly what we need to address in suicide prevention. There isn't a person who has survived a suicide attempt that doesn't report being happy that they survived. It doesn't mean that it may not be a challenge, but when they go on to get the treatment that can help and surround themselves with networks of support, recovery is possible. And the needle needs to shift, especially for young people, youth and young adults, towards mental health wellness promotion, recognizing that having complex emotions in life is part of the challenge, and that we need to learn as well as we can to advocate for ourselves and others, to take care of ourselves, to recognize when we need help, to get treatment, and to support one another.
Dr. Batra, you know, one of the things we've been talking about, all these approaches to prevention, education costs money. Having people get treatment for mental health care needs of all sorts costs money. Do we have enough resources devoted to suicide prevention, but to the broader healthcare system, to make sure that suicide prevention efforts are actually going to be useful and hit their mark?
Jane, I won't kid you in that we have a very tight fiscal environment in the state. What I do have from Commissioner Reed and from Secretary Hal Cohen at the agency is a commitment to continue this work and to look at the most highly effective, most cost-efficient ways of making progress. And that's really what we're in the middle of right now with our partners around the state, including the Center for Health and Learning, what Joe Ellen represents and directs. So it's a challenge, but we want to find the best ways of using the resources that we have.
That's Dr. Jay Batra. He's Medical Director of the Vermont Department of Mental Health. We've also been talking with Joellen Tarala-Falk, Director of the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center. And we have links to resources and to the platform at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition to find it. Thank you both for being part of the program today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, we'll catch up with the Bishop of the Burlington Catholic Diocese about what it was like to travel with the Pope this past week. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Pope Francis left the United States last night after a week of events that drew enormous crowds of Catholic faithful and people who were just curious to see this very popular religious leader. The Pope also attracted seemingly endless news coverage, and the head of the Burlington Diocese had a role in that. Bishop Christopher Coyne traveled with the Pontiff's entourage as one of the media coordinators. Coyne has just returned to Vermont this morning. Bishop Coyne, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Jane.
So just very briefly, remind us of your role with the Pope.
I was basically with the USCCB, which is the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops. I was with their communications people dealing with the over 8,000 accredited, credentialed media from 600 outlets all over the world.
I suppose those numbers, 8,000 accredited media with 600 outlets all around the world, are the reason why the Pope needed such a structured communications team to travel with him.
Yeah. Anytime the Holy Father visits a country anywhere in the world, the host country bishops are supposed to supply media filing centers and media work. So in each of the three major cities, starting in D.C., then New York City, then Philadelphia, eventually, we had to provide all kinds of live streaming. We had to provide places for men and women to sit down with their and at their desks and get out their stories. And then we had also had to provide information, provide people who could comment and do commentary for them as need be.
Let's talk about a couple of the big events of the past week for the Pope. His speech to Congress was historic. It was much hyped and it was much dissected afterwards. Since your role was to work with the media and on media outreach and coordination, what did you think of the coverage of that speech?
I mean, it was unprecedented in the sense that to have a religious leader, albeit the head of a state of a small Vatican state, but a religious leader speak to both sides of the aisle and to the full Congress with the Supreme Court justices there as well. Really was historic for many reasons. I think he went there as someone, well, as he said in his talk, he was constantly trying to talk about promoting the common good, working together for the common good, dialoguing, encountering each other, respecting each other, moving forward in such a way that we take care of those who are the neediest in our society, as well as promoting justice, not only in the United States, but around the world. I thought the media response to it was very, very good. Of course, you know, when he got down into the weeds and started to talk about some particular policies, such as global warming or something like that, there were the critics of that. But I think he said a word. He said words to the Congress that they needed to hear now in light of Speaker Boehner resigning. I don't know if it's going to have much effect, but he talked about compromise, he talked about dialogue, he talked about respectful listening. Hopefully some of that will land in the hearts of some of the people across those aisles.
You have pointed out that, I mean, despite his role as head of state, by and large, his main focus is as a religious leader, not as a politician. You know, there you do see politicians taking that message and using it for political means. Does that bother you?
It does because, again, as I've said over and over in other places and other venues, he's a man of faith and he's speaking as a man of faith. He's not a politician. He's not, you know, he's going to say things and he's going to do teachings that he believes flows from the heart of faith, his faith, and it's going to annoy both sides of the argument. You know, he says things that just makes liberal side of the agenda crazy. He says things that makes the conservative side of the agenda crazy. Why? Because he's not speaking as a politician. And yet the default for us and the default for many is to try and understand him within the political sphere and define him that way. And when you define him that way, you pigeonhole him and you can dismiss him, I suppose. But if you begin to say, here's somebody who's bringing wisdom, who's bringing goodness, who's trying to work for the common good, what does he have to say to me? I think that can be transformative for us as a people all around. I mean, walking around the street, I had people coming up to me all the time saying, you know, I'm not even Catholic. I don't even believe in God, but I like this guy.
Pope Francis met with victims of clergy abuse on Sunday morning in a private meeting, but a transcript of his remarks was released by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and it quotes the pontiff as saying, "I am profoundly sorry that your innocence was violated by those who you trusted." Bishop Coyne, were you at that meeting? Were you able to attend?
No, I wasn't, and there was only very few people in the room, and the last thing that anybody wants to do is turn any kind of a meeting like that into a media event or a media circus, as you know, can happen. And so there were criticisms that he waited too long. You know, if it was strictly for public relations purposes, I would have said, you know, yes, this should have been done earlier in the week so as to get it out there, to let people know that he does have a care for those who've been victimized by the church and victimized within their families. And rather than to allow it to kind of gain its own momentum as it did over the week, you know, in terms of people asking the question, why isn't he meeting with victims? Why isn't he meeting with victims? And those of us that were in the know saying, well, he is going to meet with them. He's going to meet with them Sunday. We weren't allowed to say that. So that was kind of difficult. But the Pope doesn't do things for public relations reasons. He does it because it's the right thing. And he has always said that he wants to listen, encounter, dialogue, and then respond. And that's what he did. He didn't want to talk about how we care for victims until he actually sat down and talked to them.
You know, it's interesting you say he doesn't do things for the media response, because some of the coverage of the meetings that the Pope had while he was in the United States criticized the way that they were structured. Pope Francis visited with prison inmates in Philadelphia, and he had shared a meal earlier on his trip with homeless Washington, D.C. residents. But that lunch, that D.C. lunch with homeless participants, they had to go through a screening process and be chosen by shelter directors. And according to a New York Times article, they were served their meal an hour before Pope Francis arrived to bless the meal, and they had to sit in front of their food until they were told they could eat. Now, the Pope has long been involved in prison ministry, and he's obviously a very strong advocate for outreach with people who are poor and disenfranchised. But in an event like this, does it wind up becoming more about stagecraft than about actual ministry?
It can. You know, when we went down in July for the media walkthrough, the original stop at the shelter in the Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C. did not include him going out, having this meal, or going out. He was simply going to meet with the people that were in the building, and there wasn't going to be any kind of staging things like this. I was, we who were working with the local folks in Washington and working with the media were saying, you know, this is not on the Pope's agenda. We've got the Pope's agenda right here. You're adding something here, because he doesn't like staged things like this. Exactly for that reason, but it was something that was brought into the script in many ways was a surprise. But he graciously accepted it and walked through. It wasn't one of the best controlled situations. If you remember, there was kind of a scrum that was going on in there. Now I'm not criticizing the folks in Archdiocese of Washington. They were trying to do their things, but just to say that he is very much aware of that. He doesn't want to turn these things into media events, And we were told that when we were doing a lot of this pre-planning, you know, there was very limited media access in most of these venues specifically for that reason, because he was there for the people and not necessarily there for the kind of media bump that it could give him.
And of course, also, we should mention there was this huge mass yesterday in Philadelphia, close to 1 million people. This was something that so many people in Philadelphia were excited to be a part of, those who weren't leaving the city because of all of the restrictions. But I want to ask you, while we still have you, Bishop Coyne, what you're hoping to bring into your ministry and your work here in Vermont from your time traveling with Pope Francis and from all that you experienced?
You know, I hope to be able to build on the goodwill that he's generating right across the board in here in Burlington, here in Vermont. I've been talking since the day I got here about working for the common good, cooperating with people of goodwill, cooperating with people who hold Christian faith but don't necessarily believe as I do in other ways, to work that way. I have some initiatives that are going to come out as the Francis Effect. We are about to make a big initiative in terms of refugee work. And I want to get that in place, but within a couple of days we'll announce it. Our commitment as a church to work to supporting refugees and all that. So we're really trying to follow up on on the Francis Effect in terms of listening to him and taking the challenge that he's given us to go out to the margins, to go out and spread the good news.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing that announcement. That's the Most Reverend Christopher Coyne. He's the Bishop of the Burlington Diocese who's been traveling with Pope Francis. Thanks to him for talking with us today. Finally today, another installment of Timeline, a series produced by VPR classical host James Stewart about the people, events, and concepts that shaped Western music heritage. Today, the life and art of English composer Henry Purcell.
The British Isles were in turmoil in the mid-17th century, racked by civil war, plague, and a fire that devastated most of London. By the late 1660s, a new hope was found in the reestablishment of the monarchy. It was thought that a new United Kingdom and a new city of London could arise from the ashes of war and fire. It is in this spirit of restoration that we see the arrival of one of the most influential composers of the Baroque and arguably the greatest English composer of all time, Henry Purcell. There is some debate concerning Purcell's family and hometown, but the first thing scholars agree on is that he was a choir boy for the Chapel Royale at a very early age. The Chapel Royale served as ministers to the spiritual needs of the monarchy, their choirs providing music to inspire and soothe the king, who was also seen as the head of the church. Purcell's name appears as the composer of the song Sweet Tyrannus, published in 1667 when he was only 8 years old. As a young man, he succeeded John Blow as the organist at Westminster Abbey, and he continued to serve the monarchy under the rule of William and Mary. Perhaps Purcell's most enduring work is found in his opera Dido and Aeneas. This tragedy tells the tale of the Queen of Carthage's love for Aeneas, the Trojan hero. In the final act of the opera, we find Dido grieving as her love sails away forever. She calls her lady-in-waiting Belinda and declares that she will perish with one of the most wrenching arias in the repertoire, Dido's Lament. In this work, we see a technique called ground bass. Purcell uses this chromatic descent from G to D as the basis for the entire aria. The orchestra repeats this idea over and over again as the vocalist sings her dramatic lament above. Though he died at the age of 36, Henry Purcell left behind an amazing catalog of work, ranging from over 200 popular songs, works for the church and the state, and many other theatrical works as well. Purcell's influence is still being felt today in the culture and art of England as being the composer who wrote the soundtrack for the restoration of a kingdom.
That's VPR's James Stewart describing the influence of Baroque composer Henry Purcell. This story is from the VPR Classical Series Timeline, which you can podcast. Go to vpr.net for details. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the class action lawsuit and state investigation in the works over the Volkswagen emissions scandal. Send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in at noon or 7. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.